welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Jeff Hoffman. Now, Jeff's debut novel was Other People's Children, and his writing has been published in The Sun, which I have subscribed to for probably 30 years, Booth, Publishers Weekly, and others. He was the winner of the Madison Review's Chris O'Malley Prize in Fiction and a finalist for the Missouri Review's Jeffrey E. Smith Editor's Prize. He is a passionate proponent of the Oxford comma, a mediocre men's league hockey player, and a fair weather fan of the Chicago Blackhawks. And the book that we're talking about today is Like It Never Happened. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Jeff.
Thank you for having me,
Monica. So is this, this is your second published novel?
It is.
It is. Okay, so what did you do before you started writing?
Oh, what a great question. You could tell by my gray hair that something happened before I started writing. You know, I read a lot, but that wasn't all I did. I've been in IT consulting all the rest of my life, and I was the owner or part owner of several consulting companies through the first 47 years, and then when I was 47, I had always wanted to write a book, write a novel. And at 47, you start to realize it always isn't going to last forever. And I quit my job and went back to school to get my MFA.
Wow, you jumped in with both feet.
Yeah, right. Like I had written in the past a novel that was horrible and will forever stay in the drawer. And I knew I wanted to really kind of devote the time to it. And not only that, but surround myself with people that were devoting the time to it and get the instruction that would hopefully help me write a better book.
And you said you'd always wanted to write. So that was like a childhood dream.
You know, I was the son of a high school teacher. So you don't have dreams like that when you're the son of a high school teacher. And you go to college to get a trade, right? So I never really considered it. I'd always loved writing. And then as I grew into adulthood, you know, that dream started to niggle, right? And started to fester over time.
So when you went to college originally, did you study computer science?
Actually, I was a finance.
Finance.
Major.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Then, so yeah, you've covered all the bases here.
I'm a mess. Not a great planner, but good at switching gears.
So I'm curious about, so you decided to go do an MFA to really learn how to write.
Yep.
Where did you go and how did you choose that place? And was it in residence or was it remote?
It was face to face. I'm in the Chicago area. Okay. And there are a few, not as many as I thought there would be. There are a few, good MFA programs in Chicago, and a lot of them, a lot of the other ones, make teachers. Right. And I knew that's not what I was setting out to do. And so there were really two that I considered, Columbia and the school, the Art Institute. And I chose the one that had the most writers as teachers because I wanted to, or as professors, I wanted to spend time with people that were novelists and learn directly from them. So I wanted to immerse myself in it. I didn't want to do it remotely.
Fortunate you lived somewhere where you didn't have to relocate to do that.
Yeah. I just had to go on the train and I was definitely the old guy in the class.
So which of those two did you choose?
I went to Columbia, Chicago.
Columbia, Chicago.
Columbia College, Chicago.
Okay. So was it a 1 year, 2 year? I mean, you were devoting a pretty...
It was about 2.5 years.
2.5 years. Okay. And so that's like, I'm just really in awe of somebody doing that, stopping career midstream and jumping in and going and getting the MFA. So was your first book part of the MFA process?
It was. Yes. It was my thesis. And you know, I went in with clear goals, right? I wasn't going to become a teacher. I didn't want an MFA, to be honest, you know, and so I chose all my classes and I responded to all my assignments in the context of writing a novel, right? And I took the novelist class twice, even though you're not supposed to do that. And you know, just, you know, when I got assignments, I would turn it into an assignment for myself about how I was going to make this novel happen. You know, from the very beginning, that's what I knew I was going to do. And that's what I focused on, kind of merged with the novel completed.
That's fantastic. So did you have the concept for the novel before you started?
I did not. You know, I spent I knew what it was going to be about. I knew the theme, which, you know, the rest of my work, I never know the theme until several hundred pages in, but I knew I was going to write about expectations and how that things don't always end up how you expect and how people adapt to that, right? And then I wrote a bunch of short stories in my first semester and then chose one, the one I liked, the one that won that award at the Madison Review, and started turning that into the novel as I started my second semester.
Oh, that's a great way to do it. So what was that first book? Can you give me kind of a synopsis of it?
Absolutely. So Gail and John Durbin they're adopting a child, and they, after, you know, many of the typical challenges in having a child the more traditional way, and they finally, after much waiting and uncertainty, they do adopt a child, and the baby's home, their daughter's home for 4 days when the birth mother chooses to reclaim, and then of course Gail and John decide to run, and mayhem ensues.
Oh wow!
And it's written from the perspective of John and Gail, but also from Carly, the birth mother, and from the perspective of the social worker in the center of it.
Wow. And was this based on a true something that actually happened that you read in the news, or?
So my children are adopted, but internationally, and so none of this happened to us, right? other than the waiting and the joy of the adoption, but that you know crisis did not happen to us. But you know, when you're in the adoption community, you meet enough people that you learn that it's often a winding road, right? That there's often false starts and things that happen, right?
Absolutely. This
does happen.
Yeah.
I was actually visited a book club and one of the attendees said, you know, I just had trouble believing that they would run. And one of the other attendees said, well, my sister in California, where they have to wait a year before, you know, the child can be reclaimed for a year. They had talked about it. What happens if, and there was some noise that it might happen. And her sister had talked about what they would do. And one of the things they had talked about was, we're going to, you know, keep this child.
And wow.
Yeah. So I think one of the reasons I chose it, because I knew how many different angles there are in adoption, right? And
right.
How many different perspectives. And as even the perspective of the child as they grow, although the adopted child was, you know, 3 weeks old by the end of the novel, right?
No.
But you know, certainly the all the stories I've read about, you know, what and the people I've talked to who have given their children up for adoption, and what they go through. There's emotion from every angle, and really, really deep and visceral emotion.
There isn't really a right or wrong, is there?
My thesis advisor is he he was my workshop professor for a couple semesters too, and so I was feeding his work as I went. And you know, one piece of advice he gave me was, make the reader uncertain about who they want the baby to end up with until the very end. And that was really good advice. And not only for the suspense in the story of the book, but it also, guided me towards, not as an adoptive father and as an adoptive parent, right? Not to, write the book as an adoptive parent, but with empathy for everyone.
That must have been a little hard.
that's the job of writing, is to embed yourself in the subjectivity of people that aren't you, right? And so it was, the short story was from the perspective of the birth parents, but and it was more of a, the reclamation happened and they gave the baby back and they grieved. But as I started writing the novel, you can't grieve for 375 pages, right? And so the story had to be different.
So how long did you spend on that, on writing that?
I started writing beginning my second semester and was submitting in my last semester to agents. And so so probably 2 years in duration with a break in between to let the novel sit and gestate a little bit before I dove into the rewrite.
So, did you have classes in the whole getting the agent and publisher thing as well, or were you on your own for that?
they have a thesis class. That was the fourth semester. And I sat down with the, again, cause I was there to get a novel done. Right. And I sat down with the professor for that. I said, before the semester, at the end of the previous semester. And I said, are we going to talk about how to get our work, our novels published? And she kind of looked at me and said, huh, maybe we should. So I think they spent a lot more time and did a great job of teaching us how to write, but it was kind of up to us to figure out how to find.
So how did you do that?
I researched, they always say, the advice they give you is choose your favorite novelists and look at their agents and then submit to them. But the reality is my favorite novelists are, have all agents that have long closed their submission processes. Right? They're my favorite novelists, right? And they're, everybody wants them as an agent. And so there's a database of people that submit and submit their novel length work, and that showed who was reading and who was which agents were reading and accepting new work. And then I also used Publishers Marketplace to research who was actually selling work that was like mine. And so I combined those two databases and made a list of about 45 agents.
So you went at it from an IT perspective.
That's the companies that I owned were IT companies. You got to find the data.
And
I did a lot of selling. So the rejection thing that comes along with being a writer, I kind of spent my career being rejected. Knowing that rejections are every no you get is a, one step closer to a yes. Right?
That's what they say. I have a hard time feeling that, though. That's why I am not in sales. Although I am an entrepreneur, and so as a business person, even if you have a whole sales team, you're still in sales too as the leader of the company. But
yep.
Yeah, but it's tough. So I was looking at looking up the book Other People's Children on Amazon, and I want to point out for listeners that I'm finding on the audiobook the author is shown as R.J. Hoffman. So if you're looking for Jeff Hoffman, you might not find that. But the description says Jeff Hoffman, but on the actual cover photo, it says R.J. Hoffman. So
yeah, that's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah. So I'm guessing Jeff is actually your middle name.
Jeff is my first name.
It is your first name. Okay. So yeah, who's so R.J. then?
Yeah, you want to hear that story?
Yeah.
So Simon & Schuster bought their first book, right? And and I was just doing anything they told me to because I was just thrilled to be having them publish my book. And you know, I wrote it as a book about parenthood and about expectations and expectations that get dashed and all those kinds of things, right? And they chose to market it as a book about mothers, right? And although they put my picture in the book, and no, we didn't, you know, I was very clear about my gender and my role in my family. They didn't want to lead with my first name, and so they wanted to go with initials. And I remember on that call, they said, "What's your middle initial?" And I said, "R." And they said, "Oh," and everybody was of the age to think of J.R. Ewing.
Yes,
And that's the first, and you know, maybe Tolkien, and thought that RJ was better, and I just did as I was told. And my mom was very angry about the whole thing, and so when the paperback came out, they cared less, and they said, "What do you want this to look like?" And I said, "Well, I want to go with the cover that I originally liked, and which is very different from the original cover, I'd like my first name on it, because I knew my next book wasn't going to be about mothers, and I wasn't going to be marketed to be about mothers is a better way of saying it. And
right.
I want to not deal with that.
Oh, you know, I can see on Amazon, I can see both the hardcover and the paperback version. They look nothing alike.
Yeah. You know, the first cover, and I, you know, when you're working with Simon & Schuster, you're just happy to be there. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And they of course say, you know, give us your feedback, and then you give their your feedback, and then they say some words that help you understand that they really don't want your feedback. But I just felt that hardback looked like a love story, and it's not a love story, right? It's a story about, you know, the complexities of adoption and dashed expectations. And it's a suspense. There's a fair level of pace and suspense to it that I think the second cover gives you a little bit more.
Yes.
Of an idea.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
So now let's move on to your current book, Like It Never Happened.
Yeah.
So how long did you spend writing that book?
You know, I would say that's about a 2-year process as well.
Yeah. Why don't you give us a synopsis of Like It Never Happened?
Sure. So four boys do something terrible when they're 18, and then their friendship falls apart around that. They get away with it, but they're trying to decide what to do and, you know, what kind of accountability they're willing to accept. Their friendship shatters, and they don't see each other for 30 years until one of them dies. And the three remaining men now show up at the funeral and see each other for the first time. And they fully expect that to be a 45-minute encounter until they meet the wife of the dead man, who happens to know everything and happens to be a reporter and happens to be very angry about what her husband went through as a result of what happened 30 years ago, and decides to draw them towards accountability.
Of course, even she doesn't really know the whole story.
Yeah. You know, there's, yeah. And I would say that I think a good way to say it is that she knew Kevin's
version,
you know, perspective.
Yeah.
Sure,
right.
And,
right.
And, you know, as you know, somebody with a bit of gray hair knows that, you know, everything, you know, the perspectives are probably pretty better aligned when you're 18. And as you retell the important things to yourself over the next 30 years, you know, everybody's version of that
is going to change. Yeah.
Aligns a little differently.
Yes. Right? Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that is definitely the case. So what made you want to write this story? It's kind of a common, in a way, the theme of something bad happened when we were kids,
yes,
and it's hidden,
course.
And now it comes out 30 years later is kind yep. of a common. I just watched a couple of Harlan Corbin miniseries that basically are that theme. What drew you to that, and how do you make it? How did you make it your own?
Yeah, so the great question. Thank you for that question. So I was in a parking lot when I was 18, and something bad happened. Not as bad as what happened in the book. There was no deaths or, it was something similar. And I did nothing. I'm not confessing to a crime, but it really
stuck with
me. But
you witnessed something.
The thing that happened was bad enough that it stuck with me all these years, right? And it stuck with me in the way of what if it had crossed that line? And the crime that happens is in its way very somewhat mundane, and mundane in a terrifying, terrible way, right? That it happens in parking lots and in hundreds of cities every Friday night, right? And it doesn't cross the line in the way that it happens in my book, but it brushes against that line.
Right. And it could.
Yeah.
It's almost a matter of luck if it does or doesn't cross the line.
That's right. And the stupidity of 18-year-old boys is at the center of this. And I'd love to speak more about the how did I make it my own, because it is a trope in literature, and I didn't want to center the book on that trope, right? It drives the plot forward, right? It draws these men back together, and I think it is the maypole around which the real story is wound, right? And the real stories are each of these men's stories and the stories of their families. And it's about, these men are keeping, or in some cases they're lying. In some cases they're keeping a horrible secret. And in all cases, they haven't really come to grips with the accountability that was demanded of them by what they had done. And that affects each of them in very different ways. My way of making the story my own is examining, how those repressions and how the lack of accountability kind of affected and in a lot of ways introduced rot and problems into the relationships that are most important to them. And I wanted to, explore that. And it happens in different ways with each of the men. Kevin, who ran inside of the truck before his funeral, presumably under the influence of opioids, was dealt with that in one way. And, all the men deal with it in very different ways. And I wanted to also explore as accountability is if my first novel was about expectations, I would say this one is about accountability. And as these men were drawn towards accountability and resisted that accountability and then made decisions about whether to embrace that accountability, I wanted to explore how that begins to repair some of the damage that they've done to their lives.
Getting away with it may not have really been to their long-term advantage.
That's that's what I was exploring, right?
Right.
Certainly from a legal and a freedom perspective, maybe it did, but from a psychological and emotional and their pursuit of happiness, maybe it didn't. That's one of the questions that I think that is embedded in these stories that get wrapped around the maypole of the the central crisis.
Now, Jeff, you have four men in this story. We don't really get to know Kevin very well.
No.
We more hear about him. We don't. But you're writing from all three points of view.
Mm-hmm.
Was it and difficult? Then and then some, yeah. How many different points of view do you write from? And was it, and how do you do it chronologically? How do you go back and forth between them? How do you know whose turn it is to kind of be in their head?
Great question. So I think there's seven. So there's Naomi, the wife of the dead man, and then the three men and their wives. Those are the points of view. So, you know, that's a cast of characters. And I'd love to hear what you thought about how I was able to differentiate the voices.
I don't think that you had any problem. I think they were very distinct. Yeah.
The first challenge is how do you, with that kind of cast of characters, how do you make sure that the reader knows whose mind they're in, right? And some of that's voice and the way they speak. A lot of that's voice and the way they think. And that gets a little more interesting. And a lot of times it's embedded in their career or craft, right? One of them is a building engineer, and he thinks in metaphors that are along the lines of, plumb and weight and gears that don't quite mesh. And another one is a corporate lawyer who is kind of thrown everything into his career and at the expense of his family. And he thinks in terms of leverage and negotiation and power, right? And the one of the wives is her mother recently died, and she's Italian, and she's heavily involved. She thinks in terms of cooking, and she thinks in terms of relationships and family, and the metaphor surrounds that Italian cooking that is it always seems to be happening when you're in Elena's skull. And so, my goal was, and I always started every chapter or every experience from a different point of view with, Tommy. Tommy was, and then his what he's experiencing, right?
Right.
My goal was that any paragraph, if you plucked it out, you would be able to tell if you're halfway through that novel whose head you're in. Right?
Yeah. I said, I felt they were quite distinct and easy to tell. Of these, the three men, did you have a favorite? Is there someone that you identify with more?
I like Tommy.
Of course.
I think everybody likes Tommy. But I'm a big fan of unlikable characters. Not unlikable. Let's use deeply flawed characters, which I think, Tommy has his challenges, but I wouldn't call him deeply flawed. Henry and Malcolm, Henry, who is a tissue broker.
Okay. Where did that come from? How in the world did you find or decide to give Henry that career?
So I met a guy at a party.
And he was willing to talk about it.
Well, you're in the suburbs, and it eventually comes up, right? You don't want to talk about politics or religion. So at some point, somebody will say, "What do you do for a living?" This was when I still had a real job, so I was able to answer it. And I asked him, and he said, "I'm a tissue broker." And I was like, "Oh, okay."
And we're not talking about Kleenex.
And I'm a curious guy, so I said, "What does that mean?" And he gave an answer, and this kind of comes into how Henry answers the question in the book. But he gave me an answer that was a little bit oblique, right? And And so I dug in a little bit more. He's like, well, and I said, so is that a tissue bank kind of thing, right? And he said, well, not really. You know, it's for profit. And I was like, oh, tell me more about that. And well, we sell human body parts to people that need them. And I kind of left it at that point, right? After I'd asked like four layers of questions, and he was getting a little uncomfortable. And then I started doing research, and it's terrifying the different things a tissue broker can mean. And I was thinking about, you know, what career I was going to give Henry, I said, you know, how does this affect Henry, this thing that he did so long ago? And how does that instantiate itself in his choice of the career he drifted into? And what more direct, the others were a little bit more indirect how it affected them. And I wanted one of them to just be directly aligned to this trauma and this traumatic thing that happened, you know, that he's renting out body parts basically to pharmaceutical or the medical equipment device manufacturers that need trained surgeons.
Which, you know, it's not actually a bad thing, but it kind of has.
It really happens, right?
Yeah. And it's important that the surgeons learn, you don't want them learning on live people. So somehow they have to get that training. And it's kind of like, you know, back in the 1800s when surgeons had to hire grave robbers to get cadavers for them to practice on.
So
I think we still have that connotation.
Yeah. And you know, kind of like the 1800s when that was happening, it would be great if full disclosure was granted to the families that whose loved ones end up in a hotel ballroom in South Carolina, right? right?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Which, from what the research said, it doesn't always happen.
I got to ask though. Did the deceased actually donate their body to science at least?
So there are the research that I've done, and I don't know how much of this is buttoned up over the years since the book that I read was written, but there are places that will offer free cremation, and in the fine print, it mentions that there are some flexibilities afforded to the cremators before that cremation. You know, that fine print isn't always, you know,
it's not what you're going to be reading at that point in time.
Right. Yeah, and sometimes there are people that are not in a position to pay for the funeral that they want for their family member.
Yeah. Wow. So, yeah, so Jeff, why don't you read a little bit from Like It Never Happened for us?
All right. So I chose, a couple of different sections, but the one introduces the characters at the funeral, and the second section is after they find out what they're in for. Malcolm, who is the corporate lawyer, has arrived at the funeral, right? And I'm gonna start just kind of in the middle of this chapter. But he's that really repressed corporate lawyer who, you know, really can't is least in touch with his own emotions, right? So while they talk, Malcolm works to match the people in front of him with the people that he knew in high school. Tommy's hair is still clipped short, but there's more salt than pepper now. He still has that enormous chin that makes him look a bit like a comic book hero. He's every bit as big as Malcolm remembers, but none of it has softened the fat. As a teenager, Tommy seemed uncomfortable in that body, clumsy, as if he were wearing his older brother's shoes. Now he seems to have mastered it. The settled way he stands tells Malcolm that he's become accustomed to its power. Henry hasn't changed a bit, still trying to wedge a joke whenever one might fit, and Alice's long, graceful body remains muscled and sinewy in a way that only childless women seem to manage. She smiles at something that Tommy says, and her perfect teeth are still that unreasonable shade of white that nobody could ignore back then. But their way of being together seems subtly different. In high school, they were always touching one another. They still touch a lot, her hip against his hand on the small of her back, but it seems different somehow, as if the contact is a product of repetition, part of a routine, a performance even. Alice is saying something about their house, its elevation, its distance from central Denver. Malcolm's eyes drift across the room and land on the casket. They still haven't talked about Kevin, which suits him just fine. If he's lucky, he can escape without discussing the dead man at all. He surveys the reception line, estimates how long it will take him to get through. He looks to the front of the line. The woman next to the casket is looking over the shoulder of the man in front of her, right at Malcolm. She doesn't look away when their eyes meet, and her gaze is greedy. "Who's that?" Malcolm asks. The rest of their heads swivel toward the woman. Malcolm looks away before she does. "The woman next to the coffin." "That's Naomi," Tommy says, "Kevin's wife." "I didn't know he was married." The implications of this unfold in Malcolm's mind and stomach simultaneously, but he's careful not to let anything show on his face. "She knows," Alice says. "I can tell that she knows." They're all quiet for a long moment, taking that in. Finally, Tommy starts talking again. He's telling them something about his oldest daughter, but then he stops in mid-sentence. Malcolm turns to see Kevin's wife walking toward them. In spite of her boyish build, there's something feline in the way that she walks. When she gets close, Malcolm sees that she's wearing no makeup, that her face really is that white. Her gaze fastens on him and won't let go. "You're Malcolm," she says, as if she's serving a warrant. "And you're Naomi," he says, to knock her back a bit, if gently. A slight nod, a pause. "Elena couldn't make it?" Malcolm struggles to keep his own face steady, even as he studies her for irony or malice. But he finds nothing but that stare. "My condolences," he says, instead of answering the question. This earns him another little dip of the head. The silence hangs heavy between them, and Malcolm refuses to say anything more. "I'm glad you could all be here," she says. She keeps looking at him as if he's a spokesman. "I'm glad I can make it," he lies, because there's nothing else to say. He's intentional about the pronoun because he refuses to speak for the others. "Kevin's will is being read tomorrow," she says. Tommy and Henry stir. Malcolm is careful to keep his face neutral. He sorts through the reasons that she might say this. She doesn't seem the type to blurt random facts. It's unlikely that she's looking for free legal advice. Malcolm's mind refuses to examine any other possibilities. "That's quick," he says, because he can sense that Henry, Tommy, and Alice will say nothing. In spite of his best attention, he has become the spokesman. "They usually don't read the will so soon." "The lawyer said that Kevin wanted it that way." Her slate-colored eyes flick to Tommy and Henry, then back to Malcolm. She holds out a business card, but Malcolm refuses to take it from her. "Here's the address," she says. "It starts at noon. The lawyer said that Kevin left something for the three of you." So then this next piece comes from, you know, right after they come out of the will reading, when they've been handed a name and some direction.
All right.
The three men file out of the lawyer's office onto the strip mall sidewalk. They blink into the Saturday afternoon sun. They stare out at the street. The cars rushing past punctuate their stunned silence. They all recognize the name on that sheet of paper. They read that name in the newspaper the morning after that night in the parking lot, right next to the name of the boy who died. They pieced together which name matched which boy as they huddled in Tommy's basement, sorting out what they had done. "What in God's name was that?" Tommy finally murmurs toward the street. Henry and Malcolm say nothing, because both men know that the question is rhetorical, and they all know the answer. That Kevin was reaching out from the grave and pressing play on the argument that they had paused three decades ago. "And what the hell is Lyndon Glen?" Henry asks. Tommy and Henry have never heard of Lyndon Glen, but Henry has. Malcolm has written a check to Lyndon Glen every 3 months for the last 8 years. When he learned about the shithole that the state of Wisconsin had dumped Tyler into, when he learned that Tyler had no family left, he arranged the move. "It's a long-term care facility," Malcolm says quietly. The other two men turn toward Malcolm, but they find no answers on his face as he stares blankly out at the traffic. Tommy can think of no way that Malcolm would know this. Henry's mind churns through the possibilities, and right at the edge of those possibilities, he begins to guess at the truth. All three men poke at the next question, the question that matters. Tommy forms it into words first. What the hell are we supposed to do now? I'm not sure about you, but I'm supposed to be on a 7 o'clock flight, Henry says, and nothing on that piece of paper is going to change that. Tommy thinks about Maggie. He thinks about how awkward this will be for her at work, but that worry melts as he imagines the look on her face when she learns his secret, his enormous lie of omission. Henry is thinking about Alice, but he's thinking of another secret altogether. Malcolm's mind is an unaccustomed jumble as he considers ethics committees and termination agreements and his law license. He tries to find a gentle way to tell them, although it's been so long since he's spoken gently that he doesn't think in quite those terms. Doesn't matter anyway, because there's no gentle way to say it. We're supposed to go visit him, he says quietly. Naomi's a reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And that was Jeff Hoffman reading from Like It Never Happened. So it's obvious that at least one and obviously more, or I know more, two of the men never told their wives about this at all. How hard would it be to keep that kind of a secret for so long?
You know, that's exactly what I was trying to write about, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Trying to imagine, right? And for Henry or for Tommy, Tommy and Malcolm are the ones that keep the secret, right? And the for Tommy, his wife is a prosecutor in the county that this happened, so that makes it complicated, right? And so they have to sort through that. I think one of the really interesting things for me, you know, there's obviously the what the men went through keeping that secret, but the interesting things for me were from the perspective of Maggie, that attorney that I spoke to, and Elena, the wife of Malcolm, and how they experience their marriage, how they experience their relationships, and how they experience the disconnects that they feel, the vibrations that they feel in their relationships that are never spoken, but are caused by that, those lies that are caused by those, that withholding and with that lack of accountability. And, you know, when Elena eventually finds out, I one of my favorite, you know, parts is when her brother asks her, you know, how she's doing. She says, you know, I'm relieved. And he says, what do you mean? And she says, you know, my relationship has been, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but my marriage was such a mess for so long, and I felt at fault, and it's a relief to know that he was damaged all along, right? And so there's so much complicated stuff that goes on there, right? And it's those vibrations through the relationship that even when the secret isn't known, that were interesting to explore and to play with.
Right. And for Malcolm, I think one of the biggest impacts was his relationship with his daughter because of his fear of what he could be.
That's right. There's very brief references to it, but lots of backstory that I had in my mind that he was beaten by his own father, right? And then he did what he did, the way he explains it to himself is that there's something deeply embedded that's aligned with his own father that caused him to do what he did, and it caused him to take it across the line is maybe a better way of saying it, right? And he's terrified that he's going to allow that into his own family and his own relationship with his daughter, and buries himself in his work.
Basically cuts himself off from his daughter that he won't harm her.
Right.
But of course, because his wife doesn't understand that, he becomes a bad guy to both of them, to the daughter and the wife, because they don't understand why he's behaving the way he is. You know, I think about this a lot, actually, in our whole criminal justice system that almost everyone who has committed a violent crime was a victim of abuse. Not everyone, but a very large number of people were victimized themselves before they became the perpetrators. Where's the line between what you're responsible for, particularly with these boys? They were 18. They weren't fully grown. There's a lot of evidence that men in particular, their brains are not fully formed until about mid-20s, until they're in their mid-20s. So, but they've got all that testosterone going on. So where's the line between holding them responsible and understanding that in some sense it was beyond their control, their behavior, or was a result of what was inflicted upon them?
Right. I was very intentional. These four boys weren't the ones that started what happened in that parking lot, right? And they tried to avoid it. There's a piece towards the end where Alice is confronted by Naomi, and Naomi thinks that she's telling Alice news, Alice, who was the boyfriend or the girlfriend of Henry in high school, knew the whole thing, right? And you know, one of the things she said is there's no one innocent in that parking lot, right? Everybody suffered from it, and everybody was guilty, and that's not to excuse anyone, right? I don't take the point of view that there's an excuse for anything that happens in this novel, right? But it's the question of what you do, right? It's what you do with that demand for accountability that happens from your actions and perhaps from others, and what happens when you don't, right? I'd leave it to the reader to draw their conclusions about, you know, what blame should accrue to whom. I'm a big believer that the reader brings as much to the book as the writer, and both from their experiences and their point of view. And I hope I've left plenty of white space in this book for the reader to bring, you know, their opinions and their point of view to this, you know, challenging question. I won't answer it, right? And I hope I don't. I hope I haven't in the book, and I won't now.
Yeah. Well, part of the problem.
The question's more interesting than the answer.
Yeah, and part of the problem is that we should hold people accountable, but then maybe help them to avoid that behavior in the future. But instead, our criminal justice system actually exacerbates the behavior usually, because most of our prisons are horrible places where people are subject to violence on a daily basis. And right. So how are you ever going to heal from and become a better person in that environment?
You know, I was asked to write a essay about accountability in, you know, the lead up to this, the release of the book and for Crime Reads. And one of the things that I, you know, as I was, it was a tough one for me to write, and I couldn't figure out why. And I finally landed on this, that accountability, you know, everybody talks about demanding accountability and applying accountability. And I think the words I use in that were, it's kind of like demanding friendship. That accountability is something that must be chosen. You know, true accountability is something that must be chosen. You see it in our politics, and you see it in our, you know, I wrote this during COVID, and everybody was throwing the word accountability out all the time, and many people were dodging it. I came away from writing that essay saying that, and I came away with maybe a better understanding of my book after writing that essay. which is a strange thing to say, right? After spending a couple of years writing a book, but accountability must be chosen, and if true and full accountability must be chosen, and it heals, right? And it when it is chosen, and it doesn't when it's thrust upon you. I don't know if I answered the question. I forgot the answer to the question you asked.
Well, it's definitely a point worth hearing and worth making. So when you let's talk a little bit about the publication of Like It Never Happened, because you mentioned that your first book was published by Simon & Schuster. This one is Penguin, I believe. It's a Penguin imprint. Crooked Lane Books, Penguin Random House. So right. Another big name. Why'd you switch, and how were you fortunate enough to get another mainstream publisher?
So I'm just thankful for everyone who's published my books, right? Will always be grateful to everyone. And book publishing is a business, and I would say two things. I think that it was an early version of Like It Never Happened that I shared with Simon & Schuster, and they were also, you know, we sold tens of thousands of people read my book, my first book, which is way more than I ever thought, but they gave me an advance that demanded it a lot more for them to call it successful. So there are those realities that happen that cause you to look for the next home for your book, right? And I want to be clear that that's not a complaint. Getting one book, much less two, published is a dream come true, right? And I'm grateful for everybody that participated and helped me do that.
Now, what's the publication date for Like It Never Happened?
March 5th.
March 5th. So by the time anyone is listening to this, the book will be out.
Yep.
And you've probably gotten some initial feedback from reviewers and early readers and so forth.
Yeah.
So how's that going for you?
Oh, it's going great. You know, I'm, you know, some writers talk about reviews as a scary thing that they avoid. And, you know, I think there was on Goodreads, there was like 720 reviews in my first book, and I've, you know, the written reviews, not the ratings. And and I read every single one of them. And, and some of them were good. And many of them were great. And some of them were good. And some of them were, you know, a little bit painful. But you know, the reviews are just emerging. And some of them are great. And some of them are good. And a few of them are you know, make me think a little bit. But the way I think about reviews are that this is the outcome of somebody spending 10 hours with something, investing 10 hours in something that I created, and then taking a little bit more time to share what they thought. And I'm grateful for that. Right. And right. If what they thought is a little bit different than what I hoped they thought, then that's a learning experience. But it's all part of the dialogue. I entered that experience at Columbia College Chicago, wanting to write a book and knowing that the odds were long against it being published, much less by a big house like Simon & Schuster, right? And just terribly grateful that tens of thousands of people have read something that I wrote, and when I see evidence of that,
must have been quite a moment when you had that first book in your hand.
Yeah, I just in case my wife and children happen to listen to this, I always say it's one of the top 4 days of my life.
You have two children?
I'm not going to rank them.
So are you working on your third book now?
I have a draft of a third book that is a mess, kind of a glorious mess. And I am right now, I'm in at the point where I need to figure out what it's about and what I'm going to double down on, what I'm going to tear out of it.
Now, when you write, do you edit as you go, or are you what they call the pantser? You know, just
I'm a pantser. Yeah, I don't know. I can't outline. I wish I could. The path would be straighter. I've tried, and it doesn't work.
So you have a concept and you have characters. Does the concept comes first, it sounds like, and then the characters.
Yes.
And then the plot?
I would say that when you say the word concept, I would use the word crisis. Right?
Okay. Okay.
And you know, concept suggests I know what it's fully about, right? Mm. And I have characters struggling with a really hard thing. And once I know that, then I follow them to, and once I know who they really are, and I do some backstory for them, but I learn by writing and then go, you know, during the rewriting, I make everything consistent and make everything work.
Right? How many rewrites of like complete draft rewrites do you do?
Oh, it's terrifying to think about that. I don't start with a open, you know, blank version of Word the second time around. Right. But I, you know, probably full rewrites, I'd say 4, 5, 6. And then you read it 100 times, right? 50 to 100 times for, you know, all the edits and making things work at a, you know, chapter and paragraph and sentence level. Right?
So here's a question that's a little tough maybe to answer. How do you know when it's ready to send out into the world?
That is a very tough question. And I think, I think I've always been wrong. Not always, both times, right? You know, you get some rejections and you learn and then you let it sit for a while and then you say, oh my, what if I did this or what if I did that? And did I really send that chapter out? and so, you know, I'm not at the point in my career where I can use Hemingway's, you know, line that, you know, I would have made it shorter if I had more time, right? There's nobody banging on my door saying, by certain day, right? So I rewrite, and so I can't think of any way to improve it. And then if there's time, I'll let it sit and then read it again and usually find that there's more ways to improve it.
Once it's gone to print, are there still, when you read it again, are there things you want to change? You're like, oh, I should have done this.
I don't read it again once it's gone to print. I can assure you of that. I didn't even listen to the audiobook of the first one.
Really?
Because I just read the book so many times and it's out in the world, you know, it's got to earn its way at that point and there's nothing I'm going to do. But I do learn more about the book by what I hear from readers and what I hear from friends that read it. To the extent that a character could have been more fully fleshed out or the way the ending landed or what people expected as they were headed in, you know, all those things are things you learn from those, that feedback. And that's wonderful.
And you take into the next project.
Yeah. And when you hear it once, you ignore it. And when you hear it 10 times, you start to think about it. And when you hear it 50 times, you say, okay.
Okay. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us today. We're out of time. Speaking of time. And we always close with a quote. And this book is about accountability, but it's also about friendship. And this is a quote from C.S. Lewis. Friendship is born at the moment when one man says to another, what, you two? I thought that no one but myself.
Excellent. That was a perfect way to end. Thank you very much for your time, Holly.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.